Suffering from seasonal irritants? As the pollen count rises, support your immune system with Quiksilver Scientific Cystaid, a targeted blend of nutrients and botanicals designed to help maintain healthy histamine balance and everyday comfort. Quiksilver Scientific Cystaid works with your body's natural response to seasonal environmental challenges, so you can feel your best all season long. Get 10% off and free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. Again, that's tryqs.com/podcast for 10% off and free shipping. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors, as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Whether you're hunting the back 40 or chasing game deep in the backcountry, the all-new Razor Guide Pack from Outdoor Edge has it all. Coming in at only 12 ounces and in a premium wax canvas roll pack for compact storage and travel, the Razor Guide Pack is 7 blades in total, including a 5-inch replaceable blade folding knife, a 3-inch replaceable blade caping knife, and the flip and zip saw for wood or bone. For more information, visit OutdoorEdge.com.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, banshee flying, space mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what's the point of galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds, for whatever you love. Infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You're listening to The Western Rookie, a hunting podcast full of tips, tricks, and strategies from seasoned Western hunters. There are plenty of opportunities out there. We just need to learn how to take on the challenges.
Hunting is completely different up there.
I harvested 26 big game animals.
You can fool their eyes, but you can't fool their nose.
300 yards back to the road turned into 3 miles back the other way.
It's always cool seeing new hunters go and harvest an animal.
I don't know what to expect.
If there's anybody I want in the woods with me, it'll be you.
Welcome back to another episode of the Western Rookie Podcast. This is your host, Brian Krebs, and I'm very excited about today's episode because it is going to be packed full of very applicable experience, tips, and knowledge from, I would say, someone that spent the better part of not only his career but also his life gathering experience and knowledge. And that's John Barklow, founder of Knowledge from Storms, recent, I don't know, is it author or producer of an outdoor class series on backcountry mission planning, and you've got some industry experience as well. So how are you doing today, John?
I'm doing well, Brian, and I appreciate your reaching out, man.
Yeah, I'm glad that we were able to set this up. I know you're a busy guy, and I know that that's probably doesn't get any easier the farther into the year we get. So it's good to do this now.
Yes, your timing was good. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. Soon we'll be getting into, I mean, already it's summer, and soon we will be getting into some of those really early season trips, and then that rolls right into, you know, the full season, and then I suppose you're busy with trade shows most of the spring.
Yeah, this is a pretty good time right now. I mean, you know, we still have a black bear season out here, depending on what part of the state. I'm in Montana till mid-June. I didn't get out after turkey. It's not really a passion of mine. But yeah, it goes from there right to a bunch of events, retailer events, fundraising events with Rocky Mountain Elk, et cetera, TAC events. And then by mid-August, we're antelope hunting, archery antelope hunting. And it just does not slow down until probably December 1st-ish.
Yeah.
Take a break off for the holidays, maybe. I have a couple hunts peppered in December, January, and then it's into show season. Yeah, so it just rolls.
Before we get really into the meat of the episode, how many of your trips are John's vacation trips, and how many of them are John's business trips?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's interesting you say that. A buddy of mine who lives in Alaska, good for hunting buddy of mine, you know, he was down here a couple years in a row hunting antelope. And so he, you know, we're just hanging out, and he's like, man, you never take any time off, or you never take a day off. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, well, you know, you're constantly working. I'm like, what do you mean working? He's like, well, you know, working on like hunting gear and stuff like that. And I'm like, dude, this is just my life. Like, if I wasn't getting paid for what I'm doing, I'd be doing it anyways, just for my own personal, and I did, right, for my own personal satisfaction. So it's hard for me to separate. But if you're asking how many are, you know, a year are, you know, Sitka sponsored, I would say at the most one. Most of them are my own.
Okay. You're just leveraging yep. them to maybe test out a new idea or a product you've had. And you're, like you said, you're going hunting anyway. You got this new piece of gear you'd like to get in the field and feel it for yourself. And so you might just bring that along. And that's where your buddy's like, you're always kind of working. You're always in that work mode, but this is our own trip.
Yeah. But it's, we say work with quotes, but it's not like I'm going to go elk hunt and not bring my latest and greatest, you know, idea into the field. And I'm a very hands-on person. So I would rather test it first before I gave it to, you know, somebody who was going on their own hunt, or a guide who potentially could compromise their safety or a client's success. You know, I have to try it first. And obviously I'm not doing it because I don't believe in it. So it's like, man, I can't wait to get in the field and try it.
Yeah.
But that's often why you don't see me post a lot about my own personal hunts. One, because I don't really think they're all that relevant. But two, because most of the time I'm wearing things that I can't show people, right? For sometimes years. So yeah, it all morphs, but I would say sponsored hunts is probably, you know, on a good year, once a year. I mean, on a good year, maybe twice, but it's been about once a year for the last couple of years.
Yeah. And that's still, I mean, that lifestyle is the dream of a lot of people that have that dream, and it's amazing to be able to do that. And that was, we were kind of talking about elk hunting before we started recording, but just, you know, setting realistic worldly expectations for really what is success in the West. And I think elk is I would say in my own mind, it's the champion of Western hunting. It's the, you know, it seems like that's the one. There's obviously other animals that are a little bit harder to, you know, get tags or bring home, but it seems like elk is the big one. And you've got a lot of experience being, you know, big part of the big game team at Sitka, your knowledge from storms, all the connections in the outdoor class, all of that stuff. What do you define as a successful elk hunt?
Yeah, that's another really good question. I'm not going to cop out. I'll answer your question, but I think that the answer changes as the person evolves mm-hmm. through their, you know, experience. I don't want to call it a career, but as they just grow as an outdoorsman, right? So, you know, I put my own limitations or my own expectations on certain hunts, and elk is always my number one priority. If everything else falls apart and I can't do anything, I can't get time off, whatever the case may be, I have to go elk hunt, at least in Montana, right? So that is my number one focus. So I've got certain expectations for me at this point in time, you know, having killed some bulls that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily recommend to other people, to include friends of mine, some of which have, you know, who live here or I even work with. But to me, ultimately, like the way I define success, if I come home with an elk or not, is I want to do what I call play the game. And what I mean by that is I want to go out, I want to find my target species, and I want to have the interactions that I'm looking for with them. So be it if I choose to call or I choose to stalk, but, you know, I want to find elk. I want to find some type of target animal or animals, and I want to have that interaction with them. So at the end of the day, you know, if I don't get a shot, like last year in Montana, you know, I had an awesome, awesome hunt whole season. You know, I didn't kill a bull in Montana. I killed one in Utah, but I got to play the game in Montana multiple times, had more calling interactions than I've ever had, called some elk in for friends. To me, that was a huge success. That was a great, successful season for me, even though I didn't personally kill, you know, my own bull in Montana that year.
That's a really good way to put it. And I think that's, you know, I think that's how we would view it too. You know, when we go on these archery hunts, you know, last year we were just west of you, archery hunting in Montana, and we got into a big herd one evening, and the bulls were bugling, there were satellite bulls. I mean, this herd was a lot bigger than we were intending to get into, right? Usually that second, third week of September, you're looking for like a bull, maybe 6, 8, 10 cows. Well, this was, you know, more like 40 elk, multiple satellites, a couple of raghorns, one dominant herd bull, and man, was it wild. I mean, that was an incredible experience, and it really defined the hunt. And then we popped a tire in the middle of a thunderstorm and had a bunch of other issues going on, and that really, we didn't end up bringing one home either, but we counted it a successful hunt because, like you said, we were in the game. We were there. Things could have gone a different direction, and we could have brought home an elk very easily.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the cool thing about hunting is obviously there's rules and regulations, right, that are mandated by, say, the states. We also have our own style that we bring to it and our own definition of success. I've got an article coming out in my next newsletter about this, you know, style matters. But I think we all have to define that for ourselves. And that can evolve, right? So I think one of the classic mistakes, my opinion, that people make, to include some friends, you know, who have hunted 7, 8, 10 years now in the West for elk archery, and they've yet to kill, you know, an elk, period, let alone a big elk, right? Or whatever you define as a big elk. And when you talk to them, you know, they're like, yeah, man, like I had an opportunity to shoot like a, you know, and everybody throws a number out there, which is almost inevitably wrong, overinflated for sure. But, you know, they're like, hey, man, like I had a 5-point come in, right? Or I had a 6-point, or I had like a 320 bull come in. And I'm like, and they're like, yeah, I passed because, you know, I was hoping for something bigger, or I heard another bugle and I wanted to see what it was. And I'm like, that's cool. Like that's cool. That's the cool thing about hunting. But I also, because they're friends of mine, tell them in the next breath that they're idiots. Right. And what I mean by that is, like, you've never killed an elk, be it a cow or a bull. You've never killed maybe something, you know, an elk with your bow, whatever the case may be, or you've never done it on public land, or you've never done a solo, or whatever the, you know, the definition of that hunt is. And I'm like, bro, you need to get reps under your belt. You need to kill your first elk with a bow before, in my opinion, before you start putting a number to it, right? Or before you start applying more metrics, it makes it more difficult than it already is, because it's incredibly difficult, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've killed some good bulls. Not great bulls. I mean, everybody's definition, but I've killed one great bull and some really good bulls. But I was telling you before we jumped on air, I've also killed a heck of a lot more raghorns. I've walked away from seasons without an elk, right? I consider every season I can think of, they're all successes. right?
Yeah.
Me killing a big bull or not is not necessarily my definition of success. Like I said, I want to play the game. But if you've never killed one, or you're coming from, you know, Pennsylvania, or I'll pick on my home state. If you come from Ohio out west to hunt elk and you've never been out here and you've never seen a big animal, if you've never heard a bugle, or if you've never, you know, all these things, I think that you should take your the first reasonable opportunity at a legal animal, target animal that you can. And I think that that will help you get those reps and build that experience level, so that if and when you get that, you know, 326 by six herd bull coming in, you're not as rattled because you've got some reps under your belt.
Yeah, I was just going to say almost the same thing. You know, I've been fortunate to take two rifle bulls, but when it comes to archery equipment, I've been a part of a lot of them. I've watched my brother shoot three right in front of me, but I haven't yet done it. And I'm still at the phase where I would shoot any legal elk. Maybe not a calf, because...
Yeah.
Right? Uh-huh. Like, I'd maybe try to get like a cow, but if there's a calf, there's usually a cow in the game too, in September at least. And so... Yeah, I'm raghorn. You know, if it's illegal to shoot spikes in whatever unit we're hunting, I would shoot a spike, shoot a cow. And I'd really strongly encourage someone like that's coming from Ohio or my home state of Minnesota, they've never done it before. You know, like, even if it is a rifle hunt, you know, I'd shoot an elk. It's okay to be done on the first day or the second day of your first hunt. I mean, that's amazing. How many people do you know that went out and shot their first elk on their first day of their first season? I don't know any of them.
Yeah, right. Well, the cool thing is it's a very personal thing. And like I said, within the rules, you know, and regulations of the state, everybody can define their own success, right? And they can make whatever adventure out of it they want. But I just think that, you know, when you see somebody who's 7, 8, 10 years in and they haven't shot anything yet, but they've had opportunities, a lot of times those are pretty disappointed hunters. And I think that they're passing up opportunities to, one, gain valuable experience, confidence in themselves, confidence in their setup. I'm talking archery here, but it could be rifle. And the other thing is, I realized this a long time ago when I was, you know, going into the ninth inning on a hunt and hadn't killed an elk that year. And it was going to be like, that was it for me if I didn't kill one, and ended up killing a raghorn. And I realized that the meat was more important to me than the horns were, and that I was going to be really disappointed and pissed off if I didn't kill an elk and have elk meat in the freezer that year. And so, you know, it could have been a cow that walked by, I was going to shoot it. But, you know, that's when I realized for me personally, like, that was important. So I just think that, you know, to each his own, right? I'm not judging, but I think that I get people all the time reach out to me on social media and they're like, hey man, like, you know, here's my first whitetail with the bow, or here's my first elk with the bow, or here's my first, you know, black bear, whatever. And then inevitably it's dot, dot, dot. But, you know, it wasn't that big or it wasn't that old. And I'm like, do not ever apologize for what you kill, ever.
Yeah.
It's not going to play great on social media, but honestly, I think probably more of that needs to be on social media so people understand more of the reality and not just posting, you know, our greatest clips from our hunting life. It kind of paints the wrong picture of, you know, what we're trying to do. Like, you come, even when you live here in Montana, in Idaho, in Colorado, and you go out on public land with a bow or a rifle, but, you know, I'm generally a bow hunter, and you pursue elk, like, the odds of you being successful are so slim. But when you, even when I live here, you come from back east and you've never been here, or it's an area because you keep going to a different area every year. Like, man, it is PhD level hunting. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people understand that. So if I were to come to, let's just say you had a farm, right? Or a piece of property to whitetail hunt. And I showed up and I had no trail cam pics. I had no idea. All I had was an Onyx map and I had to go set up my own tree stands and all that. My chances of success are far less than yours, right?
Yeah.
You're doing that and you're coming out to public land and going to hunt millions of acres of public land. It just takes a while to figure it out. And I just think that people should understand that, not to discourage them, to actually encourage them that this is just going to be a multi-year journey and that's cool and they should really embrace it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I think Randy, you know, says it really well when he says, I would rather out hunt elk every year with an over-the-counter or a general tag than wait 10 years on a limited entry. Because that
I would.
That experience you gain along the way is the entire, that's the entire difference.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So, you know, I grew up in Ohio, like I said, self-taught archery hunter for whitetail. Like, you know, again, you want to talk about another really difficult pursuit, especially self-taught. And I was miserable. Like I never killed one, right? But, you know, in my adult life, I'd travel back east and go to these different places because I loved a whitetail hunt. And I still wasn't finding success, you know, trying to pick like 3 days, 5 days, whatever, even 7 days. And then finally when I said, you know what, I'm going to either, you know, lease a piece of property with some buddies, or I'm going to, you know, chalk 2 weeks on my calendar and that's the time I'm going to spend. Inevitably, that's when I started finding some success with whitetails because I was out there for, you know, generally speaking, it took me 10 days to kill a buck, right? It wasn't like trying to kill the biggest buck in the woods, but, you know, at least a somewhat mature representative species. But that's what it took. And it took years and years and years and years and years for me to get there. And it took the same thing for elk, but nobody wants to talk about that journey. They just show like where they are in the here and now.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't show the, you know, the full picture sometimes.
Yeah. I think that's a really good way to put it is be prepared for the long game and you will find success along the journey. Like you said, it's not really a career, more of a journey. And every year you get better. Every year you learn some things.
Oh yeah.
You pick up skills, which is really, I mean, that's the backcountry mission planning and the knowledge from storms. It seems like that's what your brands, your personal brands are all about is acquiring skills and knowledge that are going to help you get to that success one day.
Yeah. And to me, that's kind of the fun part, right? It's like building that and enjoying that journey and just kind of figuring it out as you go. And that's like the evolution or the journey, you know, of the outdoorsman. And, you know, a lot of it is just trying to figure out different animal species and like how they react and what terrain they want to be in. And it's like, you know, I've hunted a lot of mule deer and I've killed some decent mule deer, but you know, I went down to hunt in Arizona several years ago in January with some like incredible mule deer hunters. And I felt like an absolute rookie first day, first year mule deer hunter. I couldn't, as a matter of fact, if they weren't there, I'd still be sitting on that glass and knob looking for a buck. Like I never did see one. Like, you know, the guy's like even letting me look through his binos. He's like, you see it? And I'm like, nah, I still don't see it, man. And he's like, all right, well, I'm just going to tell you where to go and get a stalk in. And it was just the terrain was so different, right? And where they lived was so different and how they acted. And so, but that's just a cool part where you take that skill and put it in your quiver and you're like, man, next time I go to the desert and hunt mule deer, I'm going to be that much better.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's a good way to put it. I mean, you just keep learning things and you never really know when you'll pick that skill back up. Maybe you get into a different part of terrain in Montana and you're like, hey, this kind of is a little bit of the same stuff I was doing in Arizona. And I remember what we were doing down there. And now I'm going to apply it to this situation or it's a little different. I can tweak things about it, but it's still the base is the same. And that's kind of where I wanted to ask you. So you've done it. I mean, looking at your website, 2 decades of teaching special operations forces about survival skills and capabilities, right? Knowledge, experience about the backcountry. So you got a lot of professional training. I mean, obviously Sitka is also professional in a way too, but you know, probably some of the world's best survival experts are in that group of people that you were working with on the special operations side of the business. Was there a black and white transition from training that group of people to retiring and moving directly into the like the hunting and the woodsmanship genre, or was there more of a slow gradual transition to what you're doing today?
Yeah, it definitely wasn't black and white. It was a little more gradual. I mean, I teach. We'll say I taught during the week, right? It wasn't actually that way, but you know, I would teach and then I would take some of what I was teaching, or quite frankly, I learned a lot from students as well, right? Sometimes you learn what not to do. Sometimes you learn what to do. Yeah. Sometimes you learn a different way of communicating a skill set or a capability. But, and then I would go, cause I was up in Alaska at the time that was, some of that was going on, and I'd go hunt. Right. And then I'd apply those skills and I'd learn something. And sometimes I'd learn a skill to take back to teaching the guys. And sometimes I'd learn a skill from the guys that I'd take to hunting on my own. And then as I, you know, retired and made that transition, you know, in my mind, it was black and white and crystal clear. But it has been a bit of a journey. And so what I've brought, if anything, to the hunting industry from my decades of experience in the military was, trying to be what I call a student of the game, or trying to dig in and understand the why behind things and truly, truly learn and understand how to apply a skill or why something works, to truly build a capability within a person. Right. And so if I understand how my body loses heat, then I can counter those forces to stay warm. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I understand that I taught that we did exercises to reinforce that point. We'll say, right, where you're okay, cold, wet and miserable. And it's like, all right, now you're going to figure it out for yourself. And so what I see, and it's not, I'm not saying it's wrong. It's kind of just, it's just kind of natural, is in the hunting world. When I came into the hunting world, I would see this extreme focus on, man, here's how to shoot your bow, man, here's how to call the elk, man, here's how to, you know, dope in your rifle and shoot 1,000 yards or whatever the case may be. And that was awesome. Or, hey, like, here's the latest and greatest exercise program to get in the gym and like be a stud when you go into the mountains. And I'm like, cool. But that person doesn't know how to dress themselves. They don't know how to feed themselves. They don't know how to run their stove. They don't know how to navigate. And so it's like all those kind of accessory skills are useless if you can't put yourself in the environment and then live there and stay there in, you know, with some kind of comfort, right? So as an example, you can have the greatest gear ever and you could be the best shot and you could bugle as good as Corey Jacobson and you could have Onyx on your phone and you come out to Montana and the altitude's going to kick your ass. And then because you haven't hiked enough, 3 miles in, your feet are going to be blistered. And then you're not going to know where to get water, or you're going to get water, but you're not going to know how to filter it or purify it. So then you're going to have the shits, and then you're going to have altitude sickness that's going to push you out of the mountains, and you're never going to be able to apply the skills that you spent so much time and effort and money on, right? And so I call them somewhat of the intangibles, or the care and feeding of the hunter, where it's like, man, there's so much more to this. And that's the fun part to me, because those are all skills that while we're shooting our bow, while we're in the gym, right, while we're buying the gear, we can go and train. You could go train in Minnesota, right? I could go train in Ohio and build those skills to, now they all come together. And now when I go into the mountains in Montana or Colorado or Wyoming or wherever I choose to go, I have a better understanding of, you know, how to live in the environment to give myself the best possible chance of applying those kind of cooler high speed skills, right? Of shooting, of calling, you know, of loading up that pack with elk meat, and hauling it out of the mountains. But without that, you're really, your chances of success go even farther down than they already would be, just kind of like coming out the public land with a bow in your hand trying to find a big bull.
Yeah, we were talking, there's certain, you know, things about hunting culture that have really romanticized the backcountry hunting, and rightly so. It's amazing. But those, like you kind of mentioned, those are some of, you know, maybe the aspects of preparing for a mountain hunt that have been romanticized, you know, shooting the bow, buying new gear, and, you know, putting 200 pounds on a pack frame to show that you're ready to pack a bull out. And there's aspects, like you said, that no one ever thinks about, like, Have you thought about how you would start a fire if it's raining? Because a lot of hunters can start a fire when everything's perfect. You got nice dry wood. It's not windy. It's not raining. You can, you know, most people can get it done. What are you going to do if it rains?
But that's not when you need a fire.
Exactly. Exactly. You want the fire when it's dark and cold and you're wet and shivering and you can't get back to camp.
Correct, right? So that's where the knowledge from storms comes from, is knowledge acquired through difficult times, right? Knowledge acquired from myself, from failure, a lot of failure, right? A lot of trial and error, a lot of doing it, but barely getting by or getting by on luck, right? And then not being satisfied by that and coming back and going, all right, you know, I know now that there's certain conditions I'm not going to be able to build a fire. Well, that insight alone could potentially save your life, right? Because right. Instead of stopping to try to build a fire with this false illusion, I'm like, damn, I just got to put my puffy jacket on and my rain gear and start hiking back to camp or the truck or whatever the case may be, or get under a tree and seek shelter, because it's just not going to work, right? I'm going to expend more energy than I have to not achieve the objective. And so, there's a lot there, but that's those are things we can train in the off season, mm-hmm. right? Those are things we could train right now. I taught a course for some folks, you know, it was like, just kind of a refresher for some, but for some, they'd never done it. A fire class for Sitka, you know, a couple weeks ago. And it was kind of a cold, damp, you know, Saturday morning. And it's like, hey, we're going to figure this out, you know, because to train in what I would call permissive conditions all the time, it doesn't really show you your true capability. It's like going and shooting your rifle or your bow in calm conditions or off a bench or only standing on a flat range isn't going to really prepare you for when the bull walks below you at 20 yards deep down in this hellhole and it's a 30 degree down angle and you have to figure out your arrow trajectory through brush. Like, that's not the time to figure it out. The time to figure it out is with your buddies shooting in the quarry, right? Shooting at the ski hill, shooting at the, you know, the local trailhead or wherever you can kind of figure it out, right? And that's where it becomes this year-round pursuit, where you never really, you're always thinking about it, but you're always like doing something to like make yourself better. Like, that's what we did in the military. That's how we got so good. And that's where you get true capability. And I think that's what I've kind of helped hopefully bring to the hunting community is like, hey man, there's more to this. And some of it isn't as quote cool or high speed as some other stuff, but it's like, but it's super, super vital to your success over time.
Yeah, and you said something on a Randy Newberg podcast that really Uh-oh. Hit me. Like, it was so, like, simple yet profound that I haven't thought about it, and it really stuck with me. But you said knowledge doesn't weigh anything.
Well, yeah, and so nobody's ever said I've said anything profound, so I appreciate that. But I got that from a mentor of mine, right? And he told me, he's like, hey, bro. He's like, at the end of the day, knowledge doesn't weigh anything. All it takes is time to acquire. And that's where that statement alone, what that did to me, and even when I say it right now, all these years later, it gives me a calm or a patience. And what I mean by that is, it's like, hey, man, calm down, take a deep breath. You're going to get there. It's going to take a little more time to achieve whatever level, because we're always trying to improve, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, enjoy the journey. But at the end of the day, when your back's against the wall, when the chips are down, when you're trying to figure it out, it's not necessarily, if ever in some regard, the whiz-bang cool piece of gear, say some of which I make, right, that's going to save you. It's the knowledge in your head. And none of that weighs a thing. Yeah. Right. And so you can take all that knowledge with you into the environment on that hunt, whatever the case may be, and figure out how to apply it with what you have, kind of MacGyver it. Right. Mm-hmm. And over time, the more experience you gain and the more knowledge you have, the more capable you become and the more deadly you can become in this case, say the Elk Mountains. Right.
Yeah. It was funny because I listened to that episode on a way back from a work trip. big conference, and I had a friend that lives in a different city, but we work for the same company, and he was talking about doing this backpack trip with his family, and he was weighing every single piece of gear to make sure that they had a pack that his wife could handle and all this stuff. And he's a great outdoorsman, but it was funny because I heard you say that like 5 hours after me and him were looking at his list, and it's like, he's like, yeah, it's going to be like 60 pounds for this backpacking trip. And I'm like, that seems kind of heavy for a 3-day trip. And, you know, we were right. looking through it. And then you said, yeah, knowledge doesn't weigh anything. And it just, I laughed because it's so true. And I had never really thought about it that way. But, you know, the more you know, maybe the less you need to carry. You don't have to plan for every unknown because there's less unknowns.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's kind of a trajectory for all of us in kind of our journey, right? Into the outdoors. And I think that, you know, we all start, I'll certainly speak for myself here. I don't have a lot of knowledge. I've got a ton of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
I try to buy gear and equipment as a crutch to shore up my lack of experience, right? And some of my doubt and some of the unknown. And so I go in and I'm overburdening myself with gear, right? Because I got to have this to solve this problem. I got to have that to solve that problem. That is completely natural. That's where I started, right? And then as you get experience and you start, you know, cutting the toothbrush in half and all this stuff and go, well, I've never used this before. I don't really need it. Now you get to a point where, which I think is the most dangerous part of the journey, is where you get to the point where we're cutting every single thing and shaving every ounce and weighing everything and like scrutinizing an ounce here and an ounce there. And if something does happen, you probably don't have enough experience to really get through with the limited resources you have, but you're not really smart enough yet to know that or understand it. And then eventually you get to a point where you kind of land in between there, right? Where you're like, now I've got knowledge. Now I've got experience. Now I've got confidence. And I know that to bring just so minimal amount of gear is really potentially risking my success or potentially my safety. And if I choose to go there, that's a conscious effort, where before it necessarily wasn't. But I also don't need all this gear here to burden myself with the 60-pound pack and have to have everything, you know, do every specific thing. I can land here somewhere in the middle, right, which is a moderate weight, but with this vast amount of knowledge where I'm like, oh, you know what? I became separated from my pack. I can still figure it out. Oh, my buddy's lost. I can figure it out. Oh, we got a bull down. We now have to sit on it and wait till morning. Yeah, we can figure that out, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's where we'll all eventually end up. But there's kind of an extreme in the middle before we get there. And, you know, and everybody's got their own personal style and their own kind of assessment of risk. And, you know, sometimes depending even on my partners, right, or an environment that I'm not as familiar with or haven't been in for a long amount of time. You know, when I start out in the winter on my trips, I probably carry a little bit more than I do by the end of the winter when I've been out there a little bit and kind of gotten, you know, kind of back in the groove, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the knowledge doesn't really cost anything but our time. I mean, there's maybe a little bit of money involved, but at the end of the day, it weighs nothing. And that's when you truly like feel confident, like, man, I can go out there. I can figure this out. You know, if this happens or that happens, barring something just like act of God kind of thing, it's going to be okay, you know, and we're going to have a great time, hopefully find our target animal and at least walk out of here with a smile on our face. Now it's not going to, you're not going to have a smile on your face when you walk out. You'll have a smile on your face 2 weeks later when your body heals up. But yeah,
we haven't shot bulls in terrible spots yet, but I love packing one out, and I'm a big guy. I'm 6'2", somewhere between 250 and 270, depending on the year. So you throw a raghorn back quarter on my pack and it's a smaller percentage of, you know, body weight addition than
a
small guy. And so it feels really good. And man, there's just something about that where, you know that weight is like the price you pay for a memory in a way.
I like to say those are good problems to have, Brian. When you're sitting there bitching about how to get your elk out of the field, we should all take a step back and go, wait a second. We're bitching about we killed an elk and now we got to figure out how to get out of the field. Those are good problems. Like,
yeah.
Those are good problems.
Those are great problems to have. That's the problem you planned for. That's the whole reason.
That's the whole point of being there.
Yeah, the whole reason we drove across the country was to have this problem. on the flip side, you know, last fall we had a different problem. We got back to our ranger late. It was the same night we got into that big herd I told you about before we started recording and had a great evening. But we're on the other side of this ridge at nightfall, so we get back. It's dark. And the road that we are taking with the ranger, I don't think Polaris would allow their employees to do vehicle testing on that road. I don't think HR would allow it. It was that bad.
Wow.
It was terrible. It's the worst road we've ever taken. If it starts to rain at all, it's a non-starter because it's so steep. There's nothing stopping. There's not enough traction. Well, we're coming down it. We got a flat tire. Bad flat.
Oh,
like,
geez.
Not a slow leak, but the rubber would eventually get ripped off the rim. And so we park it and we're like, well, great. You know, we don't really have all the tools we need to fix it here. I don't really want to pack a tire out, but it's just me and my brother on this trip with one, you know, UTV. So we don't have a ton of options. And then we look up and a thunderstorm is rolling over the mountain at this moment in time. And so it's like, oh my gosh, what luck, right? And so now we're faced with this decision. Do we follow the roads back to the cabin, which is like three times as long, but it's a guaranteed path? Or, you know, I start looking at my phone. I'm like, hey, man, I think we can cut this corner. We'll save two river crossings, but we're going to drop off the face of this ridge in the dark. It is steep. I think we can do it. You know, based on everything we've done, I'm pretty sure we can do it, but it will be steep and it will be new. And so we're like, well, him and Han, we're looking at the thunderstorm. We're like, let's give it a try. So luckily we had, you know, flash covers, right? We got the Sitka, just the lightest weight flash rain cover and then the pack covers. We threw those on quick and just started bombing off the mountain. Sure enough, we got back.
Nice.
To cut a third of your travels off, to have that confidence to say, no, we can do this in the dark. We can go this way.
Yep.
Like, we were looking at our map or using the tools, contours, 3D mapping. You know, that's the kind of knowledge where you have it. Like you said, it brings confidence in what you can do and what you can't do. Now, if we looked at that and we saw a rock cliff with really tight contours, we're like, yeah, I don't think that's a great new path to cut in the middle of the night.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, that's an awesome story. So you had to go back the next day and fix the flat on that steep hill or what?
Yeah, we had to. We found, you probably wouldn't know him, but we met a guy named Dwayne Sessions who he was a guide and he was hunting and he's pretty good friends with like Brian Call and those guys. And he and his brother had two four-wheelers. And so we asked him if
nice.
We could, hey, can we borrow a four-wheeler? And sure enough, they were great people and allowed us to basically borrow a four-wheeler for a day because we had to go up and get it, and then we had to go to town and fix it, and then we had to go up and replace it. So that took a day out of hunting, which is a real bummer because it was the right day, next day after we got into that big herd, and you had to, you know, leave the elk alone and go fix some stuff at camp.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Such is life.
Awesome. Great story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the end, I mean, we didn't get any issues with the thunderstorm. Obviously, no one got injured on the way out in the dark. I mean, those are the big things that matter, right? Losing a day of hunting is neither really here nor there at the end of a lifetime.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's, again, to each his own. But, to me, it's like you got to come home safe. Like, that's kind of non-negotiable.
Yeah.
And kind of what you do in between to make that happen is, you know, kind of where the, you know, the question marks lie.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, the confidence you've got now, you clearly knew how to read a map and read contour lines, which is important. Like, those are important things, right? Because if you didn't, or you don't, and you're just looking at aerial imagery, satellite imagery, and I've talked to guys, some of which are experienced and weren't running contour lines, like they get themselves into some real messes, you know, and it can happen even if you are looking at contour lines, but the chances of it happening, if you don't understand how to read maps, like, it just becomes exponential.
Yeah. And it's a skill that a lot of people, like where I live and all of our farms here in Minnesota, I don't know if we've got a combined foot of elevation change on all of our acres, right? I mean, it is flat. And so likewise, every article you read about how to hunt whitetails, they always say find a ridge, find a draw. Well, that's out. Next option. Uh-huh. And so it's not a skill you grow up learning or using. There is no contour. The fastest route is A to B. You know, draw a line, walk that direction. Right. And that's not true in the mountains, right? I mean,
no.
It's usually the opposite. Usually you got to go around something before you're done.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and that's kind of one thing I wanted to maybe pivot towards. A lot of your skills and your classes, like the outdoor class, right? Backcountry mission planning and knowledge from storms. I think it's applicable to the entire range of experience levels. For the Western rookie, right? For someone that is from our, like my hometown of, or home state of Minnesota, or someone that's from the Midwest that wants to go out and do their first Western hunt. Probably not going to do a backpack backcountry hunt, right? That's really not where most of us begin. We usually begin with some sort of a base camp and a day hunt, right? But doesn't mean that you don't need any knowledge or skills, right? There's still a lot of things that apply. If you were going to speak to that hunter, what would be some of the things you would want to make sure that they have in their, you know, in their knowledge toolbox just for like the day hunt?
Yeah. So the first thing I'm going to say, I'm going to give you a secret, and this is a big one. I'm not BSing you. The vast majority of guys that I know, some of which anybody probably on your show would know name wise, that are highly successful every year are not backpack elk hunting.
Right.
Okay. It's not often, it's not the default style, and it's not often the best method, especially if you are coming out from somewhere and you're going to a place unknown.
Yeah.
Because you have to cover a lot of ground to find elk and to be able to hunt those elk.
Mm-hmm.
And if you spend an entire day and a hell of a lot of energy and emotionally deplete yourself to get 8 miles in, right? Or 6 miles in, or 10 miles in someplace, and then find there's no elk there, it's one, going to demoralize you, or two, you find an outfitter or other hunters,
mm-hmm.
and you're like, well, shit, what do we do now? And then you're going to spend 3 days, because you're stubborn, trying to figure it out. Then you're going to realize there's no elk here. And then you're going to hike a day out, and you've just killed 5 days of your hunt, and you've covered one small portion,
yeah,
of your probably entire hunt plan. Whereas I would say, go find the elk, stay mobile, have lots of areas to, you know, you can go in and cover a couple miles easy, right?
Oh,
in a day, come back to a fixed camp and then say, okay, are we good or not? Are there elk here? Are there too many people? Are there not enough people? Do we stay a couple days? We're managing our energy, right? That's probably a better course of action to at least start.
Yeah.
And then you're like, you know what? This is it. We're punching in with a spike camp, and we're going to live 4 miles off the road, and we're going to live there for 3 days, and we're going to give it our best shot to make this happen, because this is the area now.
Yeah.
To do any of that, I think it's critical, and backcountry mission planning talks about this, and this is based on a lot of experience, not just with myself, but others, is you need to factor in a few things, and you need to figure out, first, Google Earth is an awesome tool, but nothing is the same when you get there as it looks on Google Earth, right? And so Mark Livesay has these awesome e-scouting courses where he talks a lot about that. But the reality is you can only cover a small portion of a hunt area on foot in any given amount of time. And so we tend to get a little overzealous, kind of like when we go to the buffet, right? And we start putting more and more on our plate. I can eat this. I can eat this. I can eat this. It doesn't really take any effort until you get there. And so I would say, you know, be realistic, understand what the altitude is in the area, mm-hmm. because altitude is going to be a huge thing, right? In Colorado, people get in trouble all the time, every year, to include very experienced people and friends, where they go there and they're like, oh, I'm coming from I'm coming from Minnesota.
Yeah.
There's, I'm hiking bleachers at the stadium, right? And it's 300 feet above sea level. And I'm going to drive to this awesome trailhead I found that's got everything elk need. It's at 8,500 feet. And you get out and you've been doing your, Mountain Tough Fitness, which is an incredible program. And you throw the pack on your back and you realize that a mile down the trail, you've kicked your own ass and you can't realize why you're feeling poor, why you can't breathe, why your back aches. And it's because you're hiking up a hill longer than you've ever hiked uphill. In your training, you're at an altitude that takes a while for your body to acclimatize to, and you just can't physically move as fast or as efficient as you did when you were just flying over all of it on Google Earth, right? So you have to figure out your altitude. And then the next thing you need to do is you need to understand how to read topographic lines or contour lines on a topographic map.
Right.
So that you can go, okay, you know what? We can hike in on a moderate grade or a moderate trail. And, I told this to a friend the other year. He's like, well, we want to get to a place here 5 miles in. And I said, awesome. He says, but we just can't ever do it. Like, it's just so tough to do it. And I said, have you ever considered just taking 2 days to do it and kind of hunting your way there and go, hey, you know what? Let's go in 2 miles or 2.5 miles and we'll stop at a good water source. And we'll set up camp and maybe hunt there. And then maybe the next morning, see if we hear any bugles. And then we'll pack up and get to where we want to ultimately get. But maybe take 2 days to do it. And then you're acclimatizing and you're breaking that up. Because we always overestimate how quickly we can hike over terrain, especially if we haven't done it before, right?
Yeah.
So I like to say, just for planning purposes, if you're on a trail, like no more than 2 miles an hour. Like,
yeah.
No more.
That's
right.
Fast.
And honestly, off trail, it's like 1K an hour. I normally talk in kilometers. So 2K an hour on trail, 1K an hour off. So that's 1,000 meters off trail and 2,000 meters on trail. And you want to make sure that if you do that for planning, you're like, oh, you know what? It's going to take us 8 hours to get there. How about we just stop at 4 hours
and hunt
wherever we may be at a good water source and hunt? Because you may be hiking past. This happens to me. I'm not the smartest guy all the time either, right? You may be hiking past some amazing hunting opportunities that everybody else hiked past too.
Yeah.
Because everybody feels like you're not a cool guy if you don't get at least past the 3 mile mark. And it's like, well, what about the 2 mile mark? What about the 4 mile mark, right? And that way you're able to pace yourself, which I think is hugely important, is pacing yourself with your energy expenditure. Again, especially if you don't live at altitude, if you don't live in steep terrain, if you haven't had a pack on your back, right? All those things factor in. And so it's like, again, the patience part of it. Be patient, take it as it comes, be willing to modify your plan.
Yeah.
And not be so focused like I am oftentimes. It's like, nope, got to get there, got to get there, got to get there. And I'm like, hey, man, this is my head. I'm talking to myself in my head. I'm like, hey, bro, calm down, settle out. Like, it's okay. There's no time clock out here. There's no rules. It's all up to us. Like, just take it as it comes and figure it out. And when we do that, and we're not looking at this as a sporting event, but we're looking at this amazing opportunity to be in nature. Like, that's when we slow down and go, oh man, I just saw some fresh elk sign. You know what? We just walked by a rub. Like, maybe this is a good area to just camp out downwind and see if we hear anything tonight. All that comes. And so understand your altitude, understand your rates of movement, and understand how to read and make sure you have contour lines on whatever map it is, probably digital, right?
Yeah.
And just realize what they mean, so you're not putting yourself in steep terrain, or you're not saying, oh, we're going to start at this trailhead and it's like straight up for 4,000 feet. It's just probably not going to work out very well, speaking from experience.
Yeah, I could add my speaking from experience to that same thing. Whether it works or not, it's never fun, right? So right off
it's
the bat,
it's never fun.
It's never going to be fun, and most of the time, it's not going to work. So it's just like it's not a good bet, you know. It's a lot of the things that you do out there. It seems like you're making consecutive small bets on your success, right? Is it going to be better for us to sleep here tonight under the stars because we're close to the elk, but we're not going to be as comfortable? We're probably going to be a little hungry, probably going to be a little chilled. Or is it going to be better for us to walk out, get back to base camp, have a good dinner, probably sleep a lot better, not be cold, and then we'll just wake up early and hike in again, right? I mean, those are all kinds of different decisions, and every situation will be different, but that's what I really think about a lot is this worth sleeping on the mountain for, or would it be better to just go back to camp, be comfortable, sleep well, and walk a little bit longer in the morning?
Yeah, and you're always weighing risk versus reward, right? So sometimes it is worth sleeping out and bivvying up, right? Or, you know, bringing the bivy sacks or a tent. But you also have to weigh, okay, well, what else am I going to bring? I'm going to bring the tent. I'm going to bring the stove. I'm going to bring the fuel. I'm going to bring more food. And, like, is that amount of weight I'm going to carry for the one night based on whatever experience you have, is that worth it? Or is it worth, you know, the extra 2 miles, 3 miles round trip with a very light pack to go back to camp, do what you just said, and then be back here at first light? And, I think people, we tend to get real tunnel visioned on certain things based on, you know, what we see in print and digital media and stuff like that. It's like, oh, this is the only way to do it. And the reality is, man, outside of the state's rules and regulations, there are no rights and wrongs. Right. It is completely and utterly up to you. And you have that freedom to do that, you know? And so, like, my friend who, I've been just slowly talking to over a course of years, it's like, now what he does, he's coming from Ohio, is he drives to his trailhead. I think it's at, say, 8,000-ish feet. He plans on, when he gets there, he's hanging out, camping right there in the truck and hunting around the truck for a day. So the rest of that day, maybe the next morning, right?
Yep.
That helps him acclimatize. And he hopefully, you know, if there's elk there, he sees them, but he doesn't want to walk past them. And then if he wants to go 5 miles into that ridge, ultimately, he's like, okay, now I'm going to put my pack on and I'm not going to set my sights on getting to the 5 mile mark. If that happens, fine. But you know what? I'm totally fine with, and I've already identified a potential campsite with a water source where I'm going to stop at the 2 to 3 mile mark. And I'm going to camp there, which is a little higher in elevation. I'm going to, again, acclimatize to that higher elevation, not burn all my energy the first couple days, because this is a, you know, maybe a week, 10 day long hunt. I'm going to make sure that there's not elk here.
Yeah.
And maybe I choose to stay here 3 days because the opportunity is so good. And if not, you hunt the next morning and then you slowly push up the additional 2-3 miles to your ultimate camp. And then you end up hunting there. Right. And then you haven't just completely burned yourself out, because what people often don't talk about, you know, Snyder's talked about this, I know, but very few people I've ever heard talk about this, is kind of you're pacing yourself. And you're not just pacing yourself as far as like how quickly you can get there, but that's really tied to an energy expenditure. And it's like, how much gas do I have in the tank for a week of this, or 10 days of this, or even 3 days of this, right? And based on my food, my fitness, and, you know, my acclimatization and all this stuff, like, how long can I do this and still be effective? And at the end of the day, remember, hopefully the goal is, we've been talking elk hunting, so let's just say to kill a bull, right? Or to kill a buck, is, quite frankly, once you do, the real heavy work, literally and figuratively, begins.
Yeah.
And now you got to get that animal out, right? And so you don't want to be completely so depleted that you just got nothing left and you're like, hell, I'm not going down there to kill that bull. Like, I just don't have anything left in the tank. And it's like, we need to, like, manage our energy expenditure to make sure that we can do that. And I think by doing that, and again, I'm speaking, this is definitely something I have to tell myself every year. When I slow down, when I calm down, when I take in more things, that's when I really start to get tuned into the environment. And, like, I'm not hopefully walking by, you know, opportunities and animals that I otherwise would have just had my head down and pushing right into that waypoint.
Yeah, I like what you said, and I like the way you said it with how long can I do this? Like, what do I have in the tank? And thinking back on a Colorado hunt, I went on alone because I got the points I talked to you about. I got some extra points because Colorado made a mistake. Hopefully there's a statute of limitations on that. So I got a tag, and I didn't have anyone to go with because I was the only one with 5 points. So I went by myself. It was a second rifle tag, and it was at like 11,000, 12,000 feet.
Wow.
So
that's high, man. That's really up there.
I didn't feel like it was high. I knew what the number meant, right? I mean, 14ers is a thing that people try to climb to, and I'm not that far away from it. But the valley floor was so high, it didn't seem like it was a huge mountain. But that doesn't matter for altitude sickness. And right. So I hunted day one, or scouting day one, couldn't hunt, saw a great herd right where I thought I would want to be. So good. I found elk. I mean, that I was like, I'm doing this alone in a new state, in a new unit. And this is, you know, one of my only October elk hunts I've ever done. And so I found elk. Great. First full day hunting, had high expectations. Weather was really hot and windy. Nothing happened. But then a storm blew in. A snowstorm. And so I made the decision to pull camp, get out of the mountain, go down to the valley floor, down to town, and just camp in the truck at the base of the mountain. Because who knows, right? They were calling for 18 inches of snow in the valley. Who knows what it's going to be up here? So I slept and hunted out of my truck, basically scouted out of my truck, you know, slept in the back seat for a few days. Finally, things started clear up, roads started opening up. I get back up in to where I wanted to be, and I glassed a giant herd up on top at that 12-5. There was like 200 elk in this herd. I couldn't tell for sure because I was actually driving out of the unit into the next mountain and then glassing back at my mountaintop, and it was just a huge herd. And so I got in there, I scouted them about noon, got back up, started hiking in. Well, then I started realizing I have problems. I have a few stacked up problems going on right now. First of off, it's high. Right. And I've never really had what I think is altitude sickness. So I was going to ask you if that's kind of like everyone seems to do it different and react differently. Yeah. Because I mean, I definitely noticed I get tired faster. I run out of oxygen faster, but then you just take more breaks. I've never had the systemic sickness issues like stomach and everything. Just nothing feels good. But I'm getting tired. And I'm like, dude, I'm making it like 50 yards uphill every time before I need a break, and there's 12 inches of snow that I'm post-holing through, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's just little things adding up, and they add up.
It's a lot of energy expenditure, yep.
And then my legs are starting to, like, cramp. The back of my knees are starting to cramp, and I'm like, man, that's not good. So I'm stretching, and, you know, I'll make it a little ways, and I cramp up again. Well, then it hits me, like, dude, you have not been eating enough. Like, these last 3 days, you've had, like, maybe 1,000 calories a day. And you're probably not drinking enough water, right? That's where the cramps are coming in. That's where some of the exhaustion's coming in. Well, I get it was going to be 1,000 feet of elevation gain over a mile to get to the ridge, and then about 2 miles down the ridge at equal elevation. So I'm thinking, these are things I can do. You know, I've done this before. That's nothing about this is crazy yet. But by the time I got up there, I was in such a tough shape. I'm like, I can see the elk with my naked eye. And I think I'm going to walk away from them because I don't know if I shoot this elk, I don't know how I'm going to get it off this mountain in my condition with only 2 days left of this hunt. I just don't see this working out in my favor. I mean, I thought of everything. I thought about going to town and buying an otter sled and sliding it down the mountain or building a travoy. I thought of all of these options, and none of them were looking good. And so I backed away from the elk. I went down and said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get a hotel tonight. The town's not that far away. I'm going to get some good food. I'm going to sleep good. I'm going to come back tomorrow rested and better, you know, better prepared. Well, sure enough, with my luck, overnight, that herd moved about 2.5 miles closer to the road. And then in the morning, so there was another group on them. They got within 200 yards on their stock. I don't know what happened. No shots were fired. There was a really nice bull in that group. I was set up like in a situation where they beat me, so I was going to let them do their thing. But if they shoot, this herd could run by me. And so that's where I'm going to set up. Herd moves off, herd bumps off. They must have spooked. Well, I saw where they went, and I'm like, all right, I'm just going to go get some lunch. I'm going to make sure I'm back in position for where these, they went into a patch of black timber. Like they didn't go over the next rise. This is a shale face on one side and a road on the other. I would have seen them leave. So sure enough, I get back set up. Beautiful day. Herd feeds out in the evening. I get set up on a raghorn, last light. And as I'm about to touch off on a raghorn, out of the corner of my scope, I see a really big third. And I go, that's a bigger elk. And so I look at it, and sure enough, it was the herd, I don't know, herd bull. It was a 6x7 in the 280 range. And that's the elk I got. And so it's just funny because a lot of the things you just talked about kind of all stacked up, and I made the decision to not go after them. Turns out it was the greatest decision ever because now I shot my elk 700 yards off a road, downhill to the road, and I even found an old gold mining trail that I could drive my truck up. So I had to shuttle the quarters about 200 yards. And I had them loaded up 7 a.m. the next morning.
That's an awesome story, dude. Awesome story.
Yeah, but it really shows, like, there's, like all the things you talk about are very real. I've experienced them. Everyone's going to experience them, and they can change so fast. They can, you can, in 3 days, you can go from peak energy coming off of a Wyoming deer hunt. I'm in shape. I got everything dialed in. 3 days, it all falls apart. You quit eating. You get up higher elevation. You don't drink enough water. You're not sleeping good because you're in the backseat of your truck. And the wheels just fall off. You take a day off. You rest. You recover. Get some food. And then it just so happened I lucked out and the elk got closer to me. But the whole thing changed. And I mean, the emotional roller coaster on that hunt, you know, maxed out on both ends in the span of about 24 hours.
Yeah, that's really, really good decision-making because, you know, who knows what would have happened if you would have decided to push out that ridge 2 miles, right, and shoot a bull. Like, who knows what would have happened, right? But to have that patience and to go, you know what, there's no time clock. You know, obviously the season has a certain time frame, but, you know, I'm not in the best shape right now. Let me go recover, come back here, and then look how it worked out. That's an awesome story.
Yeah, and it still would have been the right decision, obviously, if I didn't have that next day and get the shot opportunity, because like it could have gone south so fast. Like that's one of the things where I think it's like it's okay to walk away from an elk if you don't feel like you can do it. And for people to know that, like, you don't, not everyone's gonna be the Cameron Haineses of the world that can make what seems like almost any situation work, right? Like, it's meet yourself where you are in your own journey, really.
Yeah, the vast majority of us aren't, right? But, you know, when you study people that, you know, get in trouble or get in accidents, look at what the SAR groups are doing to recover people, like, almost inevitably, again, taking out of the equation like a random lightning strike or a bear attack, like, we normally are the ones that are making ourselves that statistic, right? We make one poor decision and then we make another poor decision, and then, you know, we start getting run down, or, you know, we're not comfortable, say, bivvying up overnight because either we don't have the capability or the knowledge. You're like, man, I got to get this done now. And we make a third poor decision. And then inevitably things will start to, you know, the wheels will start to come off the bus. And, you know, not, it doesn't always end in tragedy, but it certainly could, right? And we are the ones that, or the group, you know, are the ones that have continued to push that agenda and make poor decision after poor decision. And when you're not eating right, and your mind's not working properly, and you're not making those right decisions, then that's when things start, start to happen. And it's such a difficult thing to, you know, like, the discipline you had to walk away from those elk, like, that had to be that, like, that's applaudable, because that's insane discipline to go, but I know that I can't get this done right now, and I have the opportunity to come back, and I'd be better served to do that. Like, more people probably need to do that, to include me sometimes, to be honest with you.
Well, I will tell you, it sure didn't feel applaudable in the moment. It really felt like a failure, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure everyone's felt that before, but it's like, man, it's hard. It was a tough pill to swallow for sure. And it didn't help my mood at all for the rest of that day. That's for certain. But yeah, you're right. You know, it seems like when you hear a story, and people that when they recant the story or they tell it, I think of the meat eater's meat pole story. Have you heard their story of where they got that bear encounter in, I think it was a Fognac, where they...
Oh, yeah, Fognac, yeah.
Yeah, they had the meat pole, or the meat tree, and you hear them talking, like, that was mistake number one. And then they talk, and this was mistake number two. And then this was mistake number three, and that's when the bear showed up. You know, it's like, yep, you said, it's usually a multiple things happen in a row to lead you to that risky scenario.
Yeah, yeah. Rarely is it one, you know, rarely is it one poor decision. But yeah, well, I've been to a Fognac a whole bunch of times, and it's not a question of if, but when you're going to run into a bear. And then at that point, it's like, you know, how close, or, you know, what's the encounter going to look like? But I mean, that place is loaded with them.
Yeah, it would be fun to go.
And they're aggressive.
It would be fun to go, but I'd want to go with the right people.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm not that person.
And it could be a great, I mean, it's a great adventure and a great hunt. Were they hunting elk or blacktail?
Yeah, they were hunting, it was an elk. They shot, yep, I think they were doing a rifle elk hunt. And they had six people, and luckily no one got hurt, but there was some pretty wild stories. I wanted to end with maybe one final question for you, and I think it fits in because we started drifting into this area of like when things go wrong. And so what would you say are the requirements the essential requirements for an emergency kit, whether someone is doing the day hunt with a base camp or they're planning to sleep on the mountain and do some version of a backpack hunt? What would you say for someone that's new, that maybe hasn't thought through all of these scenarios or had all of these things happen to them? What would be like a way to maybe get some free knowledge without having to pay the price for it on things you absolutely need to have in your emergency kit?
Yeah, man, you asked some really awesome questions. And the reason I'm smiling is because I've been providing seminars this winter, several different places, Wild Sheep Convention, Pope and Young Convention, and then I've done some out of the Sitka Depot store here in Bozeman. But it's essentially around, you know, the title is essentially like mountain survival, but it's far more than that. But it's front of mind, and I'm actually going to record a video probably Friday on this and post it to my Instagram. But it's an awesome question and something that I think is needs to be talked about more. I think there's some definitely foundational points to it, and then there's some nuance where people can, there's no right or wrong, right? And for some of this, it really comes down to personal preference, risk mitigation or risk tolerance and experience, right? But generally speaking, it doesn't matter if I'm going out for the day or I'm going out for the week or I'm flying in for 2 weeks on some remote trip. I am always bringing rain gear and a puffy jacket. And so those that may not know what a puffy jacket is, it's those lofted jackets, and there's all different kinds, right? And it's considered static insulation. And so the rain gear is obvious. It blocks wind, it keeps you dry, right? So at a minimum, if you had to put that on and crawl under a rock, it would keep you dry and block wind. And so if you're dry and there's wind not on you, you're going to stay warmer. And then what the puffy jacket does is that loft traps your body heat radiating away from you, gets trapped in that loft, and that keeps you warm, right? So when you're stop glassing or in camp or, even sleeping at night in your sleeping bag, like you can wear a puffy jacket to help keep you warm. That's the intent of it. And so with the puffy jacket and rain gear, if I do get benighted, because you and I are trying to get back to camp, we killed a mule deer and we got stuck in some steep cliffy area. And the best course of action is to sit down and just wait till daylight and not push the issue. If we have those things, we're more inclined to sit down and ride the night out and not understand we're not going to die, right? But if you don't have those, you're like, no, it's a desperate situation. We got to do this. And that's when I trip and fall and break my ankle, right?
Yeah.
So those are the first two things. So there's kind of like six cardinal rules I have.
Okay.
So one of it is always bring a puffy jacket and some rain gear.
I feel naked anymore without my Kelvin in my pack. for how light it is. I feel like I really am like naked on the mountain if I don't have those things in my pack, no matter what the weather calls for.
I agree with you, right? And there's like, it's not worth talking about the few times I might not bring the whole thing, but I'm always rain gear, rain jacket, puffy jacket, rain pants.
Okay.
So that's the first one. The second one is to make sure you either stay dry or dry out every chance you get. And so this kind of ties back to some clothing. You and I hike to the top of a ridge because we're chasing the sunrise to get to the top to glass mule deer when they're moving around before they get in their beds for the day, right? Mm-hmm. And so we go too hard, we go too fast, and we sweat out our base layers, right? We sweat out our clothing. When we get up there, what do I want to do? First thing I want to do is put that puffy jacket on. It's going to trap my body heat so we don't get cold. And the other thing it's going to do is if you have a synthetic or wool base layer, it's going to dry that base layer out, right? When I get back to my tent at night, this often happened in Alaska where you're damp. Even if you're moving around in rain gear, you sweat out the rain gear. I want to make sure that I'm drying myself out, right? So there's ways to do it. I don't bring extra clothing. Some people may choose to, but you need at some point you need to dry even the wet layer out. So you want to dry out and stay as dry as possible because that way you stay warmer and more engaged. The next one is you want to have the ability to make some type of shelter. Again, going out for the day or going out for a week, you can still twist your ankle, break your leg, whatever the case may be, right? And even though you got an in-reach and you're like, hey, bro, like, come get me, your buddy's like, oh, dude, I got to get off work. I got to feed the dog. I got to, you know, fix the flat tire on the ATV and I'll be there in 24 hours. It's like, oh, okay. Well, I got a puffy jacket. I got rain gear. I can hang out and I can make a shelter to protect myself. Shelter is the number one survival priority. You want to seek shelter. Okay. We do that first with clothing. And then second, we want to build some type of shelter. So obviously if you have your pack on your back in a tent, that's obvious. You may have a tarp. You may have an emergency space blanket, right? But you also may just have a knife and some parachute cord. And with that, in the environment you're in, you're like, oh, well, if I have that, I can build an A-frame. I can build a lean-to. I can build some type of shelter to get out of the elements with my clothing on and ride the storm out until my buddies come get me out of here.
Okay.
Right? So the ability to make shelter. So by no means am I saying we have to carry a lot of stuff. And this is where experience and gear kind of meet, right? The next one is mentally, psychologically, be prepared to spend 24 hours away from camp or your truck or your house or whatever the case may be. So, you know, hey, I told my wife I'd be back in 8 hours. And if I wasn't back in 8 hours, to call the cops, right? And all of a sudden it's like, oh, I just killed the bull right at last light. And now I'm going to be 14 hours late. Now I'm trying to rush and do things I probably shouldn't to cut corners, right? And it's like, nope, yeah. I'm going to be gone 24 hours. If I'm not back in 24 hours, then call the cops or search and rescue. But what also that does is that it psychologically prepares you for when we do get stuck in the rocks going, hey, bro, we'll just sit down. We're in no rush. We'll get out of here in the morning, right? We'll get out of here. We'll get your awesome deer back to the truck. We'll get to town, have breakfast instead of cheeseburgers, right? Whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
But that makes you slow down and help make good decisions. The next one is, I like to say, always try to improve your position. I'll get back to the survival kit here in a minute. You always want to try to improve your position. So what I mean by that is, you know, we're sitting there on a glassy knob and the wind shifts and it starts to rain and we're exposed to the elements and we're just sitting there getting smacked in the face with rain and snow. Either move your glassing spot or set up a tarp to protect yourself, right? You set up a tent right at last light. You wake up the next morning, you realize it's in a cold sump or there's water nearby and it's going to flood your tent. You want to improve your position and move that. Or, you know, you get wet. Cause you fall in a creek crossing a log and you're like, uh-oh, like it's cold. What am I going to do? And this is where the survival kit comes in. And you're like, you know what? I'm going to improve my position by just putting on my rain gear and puffy jacket and walking towards the trailhead, which is only one more mile away. I'm going to build up my body heat, keep my cognitive function, and get there. And an hour from now, I'll be in the truck and I can sort my stuff out. Right. So always trying to improve your position. And the last one, and I'm not as good at this one, and you talked about it already, trying not to get as nutritionally and physically depleted and put yourself in such a metaphorical black hole that if something were to happen, you could not manage yourself. Mm-hmm. So you went up on that hike, you ended up going down that ridge, you killed that bull slid off the steep slope, you went off the steep slope after it, an avalanche occurred, trapped you up to your waist, and now you're like, damn, I am so depleted. I can't dig myself out. I can't hike back to the top of the hill. I have to go down the hill into a hell hole to get out the drain. Like, what am I going to do? I'm not thinking clear. I'm totally fried, and I did it to myself, right? I like to say we like to kick our own ass.
Yeah.
And so when you're building a survival kit, I really don't like the term survival kit. I like the term contingency kit. I like the term possibles pouch from the Mountain Men.
Okay.
And what it is it supplements what you already have. So as an example, if I've got a signal panel or a strobe light or a whistle or a compass with a mirror in my optics harness, I don't necessarily need to carry an additional signaling device in my survival kit. I could, I don't have to.
Okay.
But if I don't have it here, I want to have it there. Cause if I do break my leg, aircraft flies over, I can flash the signal panel, or I can blow on a whistle if a outfitter's hiking past, you know, within a couple hundred yards, and I can't whistle cause my mouth's dry. Right. But the ability to signal, I think, is huge, but you don't want to be redundant. So I think the survival kit should have the ability to signal.
Okay.
It should have the ability to make a fire. So that's generally a knife. So you can procure some wood and some tinder, right? Some prefabricated tinder. But again, if I have the knife on my hip, I don't need a second knife in my survival kit. This is a kit that I want to work out of. Like, it's a tool bag, right?
Right.
I want to work out of it. Signaling, fire. We talked about shelter. So that could be just some paracord. It could be a space blanket. It could be a tarp, something, anything like that, right? But the ability to do that, and that changes by environment. You want to have the ability to acquire and purify some drinking water. So let's say you got, let's not do the cold weather scenario, but you did the same thing that we just talked about. You went out the ridge, but there was no snow on the ground.
Yeah.
You killed that bull and you realize, damn, I've been out of water for 8 hours. I am cramping like a mofo. I can't think clear. I'm at altitude. My blood's sludging. I'm starting to get altitude sick. I need some water. And the only water you have to get is the elk wallow, right? Or the stream just below where the elk herd's been hanging out. And you're like, you know, if you drink out of that, you're going to get giardia.
Yeah.
Right. Which is the lesser of two evils. But if you've got some chlorine dioxide tabs, you're like, you know what? I'm just going to dip my bottle, drop in a couple chlorine dioxide tabs. It's going to purify my water, and I can drink all the water I need. And I'm going to bring myself, I'm going to bring my fuel level back up, and I'm going to be able to manage this situation. Right. So the ability to purify some drinking water, and then having the ability to supplement that drinking water with some just real simple basic calories. So think energy gels or energy chews or, you know, something like that. Because with a little water and a little bit of those simple carbohydrates, your mind's going to continue to think clearly, and you're not going to go so far into that hole where you continue to make poor decisions.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you have the ability to, you know, signal, make fire, make shelter, procure water, have a little bit of food, like emergency food, right? You're going to be able to manage the situation really well. And then that's kind of the way I build out my survival kit. And then what in my survival kit, I actually have a little med kit, and my med kit is just, you know, it's based on experience. It's based on your skills, but it's just basically built for common ailments, you know, diarrhea, allergies, cuts, bruises, you know, if I'm, you know, we, if we're hunting, are you capable of managing a gunshot? If you're bow hunting, are you capable of managing punctures and lacerations, you know, things like that. But all that just goes in this little possibles pouch, and I'm constantly working out of it like a tool bag while I'm out there. But if you have that, and I carry mine in a fanny pack. So if I'm going on a stalk and I'm dropping my pack, right, or I'm leaving my buddy, I have that with me. So if I do get caught out there for 8 hours, or, you know, my buddy's like, hey, I'm going back to camp, you know, and I kill one at dark and it takes him a, you know, a bunch of hours. He's like, oh, he's in reach of me. He's like, you know what, bro, I'll just come out there in the morning to help me. It's like, I at least have the bare minimum to survive and ride out the night with, again, puffy jacket, rain gear, those kind of things that I can make it work and not be a statistic.
Yeah, that's a pretty in-depth.
Sorry, I'm a little long-winded sometimes.
No, I would say it's a very complete answer, right? It's this, there, like, the context around why you picked each piece as well is important. Otherwise, people are like, ah, he said that, but I don't think it's going to happen, right? Well, like,
yeah,
what you
well,
said about
I think
the elk.
Context is always important.
Yep. Yeah, like what you said about that elk, like, sure enough, if I did shoot an elk in that situation on that steep slope in the snow, he is going to slide. I wasn't, you know, I didn't even think about that when I decided I probably wouldn't be able to get him out. I was picturing dumping him in his tracks, and I still wouldn't be able to get him out, much less your scenario where he runs over the backside of the ridge and slides, you know, that direction is 4 miles to the next road.
Oh, jeez.
So, yeah, exactly right. Like, the context really does matter.
Yeah. Yeah, well, again, I think we need to talk about these things more often, and I'm not going to tell you, like, everything I said is definitive, but there's a lot of experience there, and I think we can all build our own kits to, you know, suit our personalities and suit our environments and suit the way, you know, we choose to hunt, the style we choose to hunt, or the environment we choose to hunt in. You know, I'll carry a small fishing kit, you know, in my possibles bag when I'm out here in Montana, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I know I'm often around a lot of lakes and streams that have fish. So if I got to spend a night out, like, I could throw a line out and catch a fish and light a fire and build a shelter and be fat, dumb, and happy and get back to camp, you know, the next day.
Right.
But I'm not necessarily going to carry the fishing kit if I'm going to, say, you know, let's just say Southern Arizona in January to hunt coos deer, right? Yeah. Like, it's just kind of a wasted effort there. But
yeah, I like that you didn't really say these are the items I need. It was, these are the situations I need to be prepared for, and those could change who you are, where you're hunting, the season.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that you also called it, like, the possibles bag, and that you say I work out of it a lot. I think a lot of people treat their survival kit as the little bag I hope I never have to open.
Yeah, and I just. Again, from my experience, what I've done, I think that, you know, it's like, you know, do not break seal unless, you know, in a really dire situation. And then we don't work with those things and train with them enough and use them often enough. It's like I said, I broke out my survival kit. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I use my prefab tinder. I use my knife. I use those kind of things, you know. And then I sharpen the knife and restock the prefab tinder, and I know it's good to go. And I put some more fluid back in the lighter and all those kind of things. And so now I was good to go. And if we think about it, you know, as a possibles bag or maybe a tool kit, then it's like, oh, I got diarrhea, I'm going to get into my medical kit. It's like, I'm not going to have a separate medical kit that I have those pills in and not touch the survival kit, right? And I think it's important also that we all individually build our own kits. So that I know if my buddy is stuck on the mountain, right? Because you killed a buck at last light and I got bored and went back to camp to cook, you know, beef stroganoff or whatever. I'm like, he's good. He's got his kit, right? Like, he can manage himself. I'll get up there in 3 hours. I'll know he's probably got a fire going to keep the black bears away, and I'll be able to find him and blah, blah, blah. But oftentimes guys are like, oh, well, you got the survival kit, I don't need one. And I'll give you a classic case in point. The only reason I'm mentioning this is because I did a podcast with Randy and Corey Jacobson, and Corey was the one that wanted to do it. And we specifically talked about his film Alaska Elk, and, you know, those guys, as experienced as Corey and Donnie are, like, Corey made the classic mistake. And it's like, they set up camp and they're like, oh, we see some elk and we're going to go chase elk in the afternoon. And it's only 1 mile away. And then they kept moving and it's like 4 miles away now. Then they killed the elk at last light. Then they couldn't get back to camp and they had to keep the bears away. And then they didn't have puffy jackets. They didn't have rain gear. Luckily, they found a tarp. You know, they didn't have a survival kit. They didn't have the basic necessities. And it wasn't like, you know, Corey had nothing. At least Donnie had a few things. And he self-admitted this. That's why I'm able to talk about it, because it's public. You can go listen to the podcast. And we just went through the lessons learned. And it's like, man, it can happen to any of us. It can happen to me, right? Like, none of us are infallible. But it's like, to think it's not going to happen to you is just completely naive and unrealistic. Like, these situations are going to arise. The more time we spend out there, the greater the opportunity for these things to happen. It's a very dynamic environment that's not controllable. And so we just need to make sure we're as prepared as possible. When you're inexperienced, you tend to do that with a lot of gear. And when eventually you get to a point where you have experience, you do it with a lot of knowledge and a minimal amount of gear, but you still have that capability. And that's what ultimately is important, is that you're wide-eyed about it, you understand it, you prepare for it. And then when it happens, hopefully nothing death-defying, but when it happens, then you can react to it. And like I say, instead of becoming a statistic, you just have an awesome story to tell around the campfire to your buddies.
Yeah, that should be a shirt for you, is stories before statistics.
I love that, man.
Yeah.
I love that.
That'd be great right underneath the homepage of the Knowledge from Storms. So
stories, not statistics. I dig it. I'll give you credit for that if I use it.
Awesome. Well, man, just like that, we racked up an hour and a half of incredible experience, knowledge, tips, a couple stories along the way. I really appreciate you sharing some of your knowledge with our listeners on not only like what can go wrong, but also how to overcome those situations, how to work the problem, how to be better suited to handle, like you said, it's the when, not if situations.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you having me on, man. I love to teach. I love to help people. I think we need more experienced people in the hunting industry, providing that knowledge and experience to help people who either haven't done something, you know, like come out west or are new to hunting. We need more people to do that. And so I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to come on and talk about it.
Yeah. And give people the opportunity to check out not only your website, but your outdoor class, the course, and how they can really get, I would say, what's the full version of today's podcast.
Yeah, so I have an Instagram page at Jay Barklow, so my last name, where I try to post a video a week of just some type of educational content. I've got a website, knowledgefromstorms.com, where that's all free content, education, my newsletter, pre-trip planning checklist, you name it, podcasts. And then I've also just got my first outdoor class done, so backcountry mission planning. If you use the code Barklow, all capitals, that's 20% off. I think it's 30% off through Labor Day, but it's 20% off. You can get a full year's membership, not just to my course, but everything on outdoor class, Randy's courses, Corey's courses, Remy Warren's courses, but backcountry mission planning. And it's a perfect time to talk about it, because the whole intent of that is to help us all plan and prepare and train to have the best, most successful, safe, big game season we can this fall. So yeah, I appreciate that. And that's at outdoorclass.com, man.
Yeah, I have outdoor class opened up right now, and the full price is $833 a month, which if I do my math right, it's like $100 a year.
Yep. $99.99. Yep.
And so you're getting like just your course alone is 16 full chapters.
Yes.
Yep. And so I would say if you need to use anyone's course, if you use John's course, you will be happy to spend that $100 for the misery and the discomfort you avoid by using it. But also, like you said, you get Randy's. I think he's got the antelope course. Corey's got an elk hunting course. Is Remy's mule deer?
So Corey's got all of Elk 101 on outdoor class that you get access to. Randy's done a rifle elk hunting course. He's done an antelope hunting course. Remy's done a mule deer hunting course. Hank Shaw has One course out now on how to butcher and cook your wild game. He's got another one coming out. Don't want to spoil it, but he's got another one coming out. There's ones coming out from Mark Livesey. Like, it's insane. Jamie Tegan's got a cooking course, and I've got more courses I'm building. Like, it's going to be the one-stop shop for everything outdoor education. And, to me, it's a tremendous resource. I'm a huge fan, as you could tell.
Yeah.
Not just because I'm on there, but I would take it. Honestly, I would sign up just for Randy's antelope course.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to, because my wife she's in the final weeks of a 2-year pharmacy residency. And she said she wants to go antelope hunting, because I was watching a Fresh Tracks episode, and Randy, he had a guest and they did the hotel, and he went and got donuts, and they drove around and they found some antelope, had a great time. And she goes, I want to do that. And so that's her view of antelope hunting. And I'm not the most experienced antelope hunter, so I think I'm going to have to get the course just to learn and take her on an antelope hunt.
I don't know of any other course in the world on antelope hunting. And so I'm super intrigued, and I've hunted antelope for a long time and been, you know, somewhat successful, but that course alone is so unique to me that content is valuable. I will tell you, I'll give you another quick little secret before we sign off. But to me, I think antelope hunting is an undervalued pursuit out west that people would really find a lot of value in. Tags are easier to draw, far easier to draw. Some are over the counter, depending on the state. They're far less expensive. You don't have knee pack horses to bring them out. You hunt them all day long because, generally speaking, there's a lot of them and you get lots of stalks in, and the success rate is far, far higher, especially with a rifle, than any elk hunt will ever be in the world. So I think it's a great opportunity for people. And antelope, if you take care of it, i.e. you just don't let it rot in the sun, because oftentimes it's hot, it is some of the best venison you'll ever eat.
I think it's funny you say that, because every time someone asks me about hunting the West, I always recommend you should start with a rifle antelope hunt. It'll be the most fun way to get into the West.
Absolutely.
I tell them there's levels of skills, and to do a day hunt or a backpack hunt for bighorns, you need them all. To do an antelope hunt, you can start with nothing. You're going to have fun. You're going to see animals. Like, you don't have to get up early. You're not doing 3-hour hikes in the woods at night. You can get them out of the field easy. I mean, there's nothing about an antelope hunt that a whitetail hunter from Minnesota couldn't take on.
And absolutely.
And it's type one fun along the way too. Whereas the bighorn hunt or the mountain goat hunt or the limited entry elk hunt in Idaho, that's a lot of type two fun.
Yeah, it might even be type three.
Yeah, yes. Which is just a longer buy-in period to get to start smiling. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, well, thank you, John. Thanks for sharing, and thanks for giving everyone a place to go follow you, go check out your website, full of great information, and hopefully get an outdoor class and start their Western hunting journey.
Yeah, thanks again, Brian.
Yep, and thank you, folks, for listening.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.